Hello, hello, and welcome to Ben Doesn't Know What's Going On, a podcast where... Wait a minute.
Uh-oh.
Wait a minute. Can we cut the music? I think I messed up. Take two.
Okay.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Dr. Ben Doesn't Know What's Going On. Where independent Christian church pastor Dr. Ben Lee is so busy being smart, he doesn't have time for mundane things like keeping up with the news. So we catch him up. I'm Daniel Silliman, news editor for Christianity Today, and you're listening to Dr. Ben's News Time Radio Hour. Today's episode is brought to you by that thing where someone is telling you a story and you can tell they've told it before. Better be a good story. If this is really good, I'll allow it, but you're gonna have to deliver. That thing where someone tells you a story they've told before. Available everywhere people are telling other people stories. Benjamin, you have some. We have some very local news, yeah?
We do. We have here in Northeast Tennessee, local pastor barely crosses the finish line.
Demon.
Yeah.
Doctorate of ministry. Yeah.
Your wife actually shared with me, a friend of hers said it felt like when they finished, I forget what it was, it was either PhD or a doctorate,
yeah.
Where they crossed the finish line and their bike breaks. That's
yes.
That was the feeling.
Yes. The bike only, your dissertation is a bike that only has to get across the line. It doesn't have to, it can fall apart immediately on the other side. It doesn't need to cross it and be rideable anymore. Yeah.
I said, well, that's a fantastic metaphor. I personally feel like I have fallen off the bike, broken multiple bones, compound fracture, pushed the bike across the finish
still
line.
Counts.
It crashes, still and I point with my bloody
counts.
Nubs. Does that count? Surely that counts. And they say, yes, that counts.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. They say, congratulations, Dr. Benjamin Lee. With
yes,
all
it
of
was...
the honors conferred upon you. No, congratulations.
Well, thank
that
you.
That is a real... Yeah. Accomplishment. I think it puts you in the top like 1% of educated Americans.
Oh yeah,
it's pretty unusual.
It took
pretty special.
It took a village. It
took a minute.
It took a minute and a village. It took both and probably more.
And what was the name of your project that you wrote?
I can. The subtitle is constantly changing.
Sure,
but crafting a rule of life. A holistic approach to Christian spirituality. I get more specific, but I think that's the gist. Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah,
people mention to me on a regular basis that they feel bad that we make fun of you on this podcast all the time, and sort of at the beginning and end of every show, we talk about how little you know, and how that's obviously not true. So we should take a moment to acknowledge.
Well, thank you. Yes, but I also
things Ben knows.
I don't mind acknowledging, and there's plenty of places.
Yeah.
Where I don't know what's going on. So,
it
is good from time to time.
As with us all.
Hey, there are small circles. We can draw a circle and say, in that circle, Ben knows what's happening.
And in terms of taking that spirituality of a rule of life and making it useful to people, you know a lot.
Yes.
And very specific.
More than average.
So, Well, quite a bit more than average.
Well, good.
You're in the top percentile.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
If we took all the people and lined them up, you wouldn't be like slightly above the middle on this
one. That's what I was shooting for.
Yeah. Slightly above average. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Great accomplishment.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And thank you for, you've given me support. Before we record here, we usually talk for about an hour catching up. And some of those times I've shared with you, I think I'm an idiot.
The struggle.
I don't think I can talk in a complete sentence. I don't know what the English language is.
Overrated. Not important.
When you're trying to write.
Just throw out words.
Yeah. When you're trying to crank out summaries and assessments of things. And it just feels when you do it so long that you're just speaking gibberish. And you lose confidence. And it's just been a number of times you've encouraged me and kind of said, yeah, it's just par for the course. That's what writing is about, is dealing with some of those feelings of inadequacy, and you just gotta push through and rely on good friends and editors to tell you when you're doing it right and nudging you in the right direction when you're needing a little help. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, so thankful for that.
Yeah.
Speaking of also, and this is a pivot. This is a pivot, or we're a segue
transition.
Into our news.
Great.
This is transition into the news, but also people who know a lot about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I want to celebrate in front of all of our listeners just how much of the news that you know.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
I do know a lot of.
And
lot
you
of
were just sharing, and I want to share with others that you are swimming in the deep waters of current events and news every day. You have a newsletter that you send out that's just really a cross section of for Christianity Today, right? A newsletter that's like, here's some of the important things that are happening that concern the church and Christianity.
Christians throughout the world.
Throughout the world.
Yeah.
But in order to get that information, you've got to be swimming in the larger pool every day.
It's true.
And then you're teasing out of all of that, both the stuff that affects the church, but also the stuff that just affects the wider human race. And you are curating it for me and our listeners. And our listeners. I want to express my gratitude.
You're welcome.
For that. I really do. And I want to acknowledge that that's a boatload of work to be doing all of that. So I'm glad you're able to share, and that I'm just grateful that I get an opportunity, because otherwise, as you know, when you text me the day before, what are some of the headlines you think we might need to touch upon? It's slim pickings. So thank you for bringing your abundance.
You're welcome.
And your gifts and your vocation and your craft. So yeah.
So this week.
This week.
What would you like to know about?
Monday. So we didn't put an episode out last week because, as you mentioned, I was turning in the last parts of my demon project.
I was traveling and you were
And Monday,
riding,
I guess,
that bicycle.
Sunday, I heard, over the weekend, I don't know when it happened, but some heavy movement with the conflict with Israel and Iran.
Yeah.
Other people I know are involved, but we had talked, I think the last we had talked was Israel had bombed an Iranian embassy in Syria. Is that right? Yes! And so there was some backlash with
that. And there was concerns about retaliation and escalation. And then what we saw, what you're describing, is the retaliation.
Of that particular thing we had talked about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't remember
didn't get details. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't get details. Yeah, yeah. Other than that there was retaliation.
Sure. So on Sunday, April 14th, so a couple weeks ago a week ago from when listeners will listen, Iran fired 150 missiles and 170 drones. Armed drones at Israel in response to this attack on the embassy in Syria, which killed top security officials who Israel considered responsible for the attacks from Hamas and supporting Hamas and the attack on Israel. So Iran launched this fleet of missiles, 120 ballistic missiles, 30 cruise missiles, and 170 armed drones, which drones have been rapidly increasing as a military tool. I mean, we've seen this in Ukraine. The first time I was aware of drones was in Afghanistan, the American war in Afghanistan, but I just feel like the technology has gotten much more. That's like a fleet of violent, deadly, lethal drones flying from
remote control planes,
Iran,
remote control bombers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So they launched this Sunday night, April 14th, in response to the attack on Syria. Kind of amazingly, though, 99% of those, a little more than 300 weapons, were shot down. Mm-hmm. They were shot down by Israel's security system, the Iron Dome, some of which was funded by Obama back in the day. They were shot down also by allies. America got involved. France got involved. Jordan got involved, which is interesting. Jordan
in the defense.
Like Jordan is not I mean, it's a Muslim country that it often has more in common with other Muslim countries than with Israel. But in this case, they worked to try and stop it. So 99% of these things were destroyed, and there were no casualties. There were some
at all.
There were some injuries, but and it's possible that some of the injured people are seriously injured and will eventually die from their injuries. It's not, you know, bloodless firing 300 missiles, but 99% of them were destroyed and nobody died, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah. So can I mean
yeah, do go you want to ask more? Sure, okay. Go for it. I have more, but
okay.
It's good.
I'm just I'm imagining this the scale of which stuff is coming in.
Like a flock of birds, basically, right. But
and,
missiles.
I can understand the sort of the Iron Dome if you have like just land.
It's basically missiles that shoot missiles. Yeah.
Was any of this shot down? I mean, you said
there were also America, like fighter jets.
And, yeah, how, did they just the response time is what I'm after. I'm just wondering, like,
so this is
how
one
do they respond to something
curious
like that?
Detail. Iran told a bunch of people that it was going to do this first.
Huh.
So Israel and the United States knew this was coming, which allowed for a certain level of preparation and response. Some of it is automated, the Iron Dome
right. Yeah,
works
that part
when
of
it does,
yeah,
but
that.
Like
yeah.
having the fighter pilots, you know, not taking a break, drinking coffee, but like ready to go, seems like it was a response.
So have people speculated, do you think that they leaked the information early because they really didn't want to actually be successful, but they wanted to save face and say, oh, we're retaliating?
Maybe.
Okay.
I mean, there's definitely a ton of, well, so they might have just done it because they needed their allies to clear airspace. Like,
yeah,
I don't want to accidentally hit Syrian jets on the way over.
Okay.
It's not like Iran, you know, go look at a map, but Iran isn't next door. There's other stuff. So maybe there were like practical reasons that they had to do it. But it is possible that, you know, there's the internal pressure to show strength and there's external pressure not to escalate.
Right.
So
yeah, that's
maybe doing this is a way of doing both of those. It certainly, you know, I don't think we can prove that that's what they intended, but it does have that effect of not escalating as much as it could, but also satisfying a certain local demand, domestic demand to like not be shamed by being attacking and not responding, which, you know, has then been the question since then. So in the week since this attack, there have been just really intense debates about whether Israel needs to respond. And President Biden has been like, please don't escalate, please don't escalate, please don't escalate. Like, declared a victory because you shot all of these things down.
Yeah.
And then you don't need to do it. You showed strength.
Yeah.
And Israel was very clear, no, we're going to retaliate and we have to retaliate. Otherwise, like, anyone will think they can fire missiles at us at any time. There also were some hawks.
And it's almost like, no, they won't. Come on.
I don't know.
Cause
I don't know.
You shot in the embassy, right? Like,
yeah.
So this is...
You killed some people.
This wasn't a random retaliation.
And
then
they missed.
This is
an
okay time to pause.
Yeah. There also were...
Especially since there was no casualties.
Some international people, some hawks, including a bunch of American hawks, including, you know, pro-war people who were involved, for instance, in the U.S. invasion of Iraq, who really see Iran as a problem and were even saying things like, this is an excuse, this is an opportunity. We have to take this opportunity to attack Iran and destroy its nuclear capabilities. And the only way, I mean, part of the argument is that the only way to prevent war is to show strength.
Mm.
Which in some cases is war. So that's a little ironic that the only way to prevent war is to be at war. I don't, that's not quite their argument, but
it's getting there.
It's pretty close. At least sometimes it's pretty close. So, you know, there were some other options on the table. Like there was talk about doing a cyber attack, for example, something that's not quite as dramatic. There was talk about doing sanctions or some kind of diplomacy. It's not like military response is the only way to retaliate. However, on Thursday night, late last week, as people are listening, so almost a week after the attacks, I think I have those dates right, Israel did respond. We don't know yet the scale or scope, but both the American military and the Iranian military have confirmed that Israel fired weapons into Iran. There were explosions. It doesn't seem like it was quite full scale. It does seem similar to what happened in Iran, in that like it's enough to satisfy and say that we did a thing, but not as aggressive as it could have been. There's some restraint. So we'll probably learn more about it in the next few days. Maybe they hit some military installations. Maybe they hit some, I don't know, like technical transportation hubs. Like we don't know. But there's at least some hope that this is as much as it will escalate. I mean, this has been the concern for weeks, right?
Yeah.
For months, that this conflict in Israel and between Israel and Hamas is just has such a potential to consume everybody in a conflict in the Middle East, and it has so many ways to escalate, and the people in power don't seem to be super into restraints. Maybe they're showing some restraint, but strength seems to be their first and last concern. You know, and politically it gets really tricky, because like we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, Netanyahu's facing political challenges at home. If Iran is an enemy, that's actually gonna cause the criticism of him to decree, right? There's some advantage to him in being in a conflict, while that's very bad for the world.
Yeah.
But the incentives don't always line up for people. But a lot of the world, including the leaders of the United States and the leaders of Great Britain and the leaders of France and Germany, have been saying, don't escalate, don't escalate, don't escalate, please don't escalate.
Yeah.
Let's everybody just take a minute. Yeah. Let's go for a walk.
Yeah. Please.
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 Yeah. What are, let's be creative.
Yeah.
Brainstorming.
And can we give y'all lunch? Can we treat you to dinner? Both of y'all. I would separate occasions.
Have you tried sleeping on it? So that second retaliation, the retaliation to the retaliation, just happened. And, you know, we're still waiting for more information, which will also tell us what Iran is likely to do next, right? Is there a way that Iran can kind of absorb this?
Right.
Or can de-escalate? Like, the U.S. doesn't quite have as much of a voice to tell Iran,
yeah,
hey, maybe try sanctions or something like that. So, I don't know. I don't know what happens, but continue to be hopeful that it doesn't spiral into a region-wide conflict, which it seems to want to do.
Okay. Today's episode is also brought to you by Bittersweet Going Away Parties. It's nice to see people graduate and go to bigger and better things, but also, we're gonna miss them. Bittersweet Going Away Parties. Bitter, but also sweet. Daniel.
It's graduation season here.
That.
And ordination season, and moving out parties, and
that hits a little too close to home, that advertisement. It is definitely bittersweet.
Every year.
Yeah. Some years more than others.
Well, that's true. And also, like, I also find as time goes on that it's happening faster and faster. Like, I'm like, we just got to know you guys.
Yeah.
More people
we got to know. It was
just 4 years ago.
Just when you started to become interesting.
Yeah.
Where I enjoyed hanging out with you.
Exactly.
Yeah. I had to work at first.
Well, again, some more than others.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Hey, couple other news stories. Two other hard news stories that I think you want to know. And then one good news story, fun story that I have to end on.
As a dessert.
As an up note. First of all, this last week, a jury in New York was seated for the first ever criminal trial of an American president, former American
president. Which president?
Yeah, curious. Yeah. It was Abraham Lincoln. No. Yeah, Donald Trump. This is the hush money trial.
Okay.
That has now got to the part of being an actual trial. They spent all last week interviewing jurors, going through voir dire, which is a fun process. It's the process of selecting a jury.
Voir dire.
We have a French name for it. They have to fill out questionnaire with like 45 questions. The judge interviews them, and then the lawyers for both sides get to like ask them questions like, what are your opinions of Donald Trump?
Right.
Can you be fair? What do you think about Donald Trump's tie? Or whatever. They can really ask for anything. And it's interesting. I've sat through this process a number of times when I was a cops and courts reporter. They have a certain number that they can dismiss without any explanation. Mm-hmm. They just go, I don't like the cut of your jib. Like, you're out. But all of the potential jurors are ranked or are in numbered order. So if they do that, they don't get to pick out of the whole pool. Just the next person moves up. So they have to make an evaluation like, oh, maybe I think a white man would be more sympathetic to my client. But if I get rid of this Hispanic man, the next person is a black woman. So I have to make those decisions. And then you have a certain number you can also dismiss for cause. Like, you can make an argument, this person's not going to be fair, and here's why. They posted a lot of memes on the internet that evidence certain kind of political bias or something like that. Or they love cops and are more going to believe the cops and not accept any
counter evidence the pool?
Or whatever. So in this case, the pool was maybe 100-something people, 120 people,
and so both,
to pick 12.
Okay, and so both the prosecution and defense are going to have time to review all 100?
No, they start with one. Start with number one, and you stop when you have 12 people. You just, like, you go through the process. So you could never get questioned.
Okay.
If you're number 20, 120 in the jury.
Right, but let's say Julia is the first one. Julia comes up. And
the judge asks her questions.
So then
the judge asks questions for like a group of like 18 or 15 or something. And then the lawyers get to go with them and they go one at a time and dismiss them. And then they're like, okay, we have seven. So at the end of one day, they had seven jurors.
Yeah. Okay.
And then they just pulled up another group.
I'm just saying, when do they do some of their background research on some of these?
Sometimes they research all of them ahead of time.
Okay.
And then sometimes they're doing it on the fly.
Okay.
And making decisions. They won't know, like, the number until they're there.
Yeah, I got you.
They'll know the whole pool, but...
Yeah.
There were, apparently, teams of people, like, researching, like, Facebook posts.
As
it was happening.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
As well as asking them questions and...
So, is that done?
So, as of the end of last week, as
they've
people are listening, they have a jury seated. Opening arguments are probably going to start on Monday morning.
Oh, okay.
In this first
is it televised?
Criminal trial.
These are some of the things.
It is not televised.
Okay.
And there's no audio either. So the room is full of reporters. I read that they can't actually talk on the phone, so they have to like go to the bathroom. The bathroom is the one place that has good reception, so they're all like running to this one bathroom that they've turned into to where they can check in with their editors.
So lots of hullabaloo.
You don't actually go to the bathroom in that bathroom. It's now a phone bank.
That'd be fun to be, if you weren't in the trial, just go happen to be in the bathroom.
You can, they're open. You can go to a trial.
And just stand there and listen to all the reporters.
You can sit in the courtroom. Yeah. It's open to the public. If there's seats, you know, it'll probably be fill up for this one. But
do you have tents? Do they have tents outside waiting?
Open. Yeah. So a couple things about the trial, just as it happens, that are worth paying attention to or worth thinking about as they happen. It's the accusation is that he falsified business records. There are 34 counts. The claim is that during the 2016 election, there were two different women, both of them who had a career in pornography, who'd had sexual affairs with Donald Trump, and were going to tell people about it for money, wanted to sell their stories. And in both cases, Donald Trump managed to pay the person for their story and then make sure it didn't get told. This is being presented by the prosecution as not only a matter of falsifying the records, but also interfering with the election. They're really, he's really trying to frame it as like voters deserve to know these facts, and you lied and lied on your paperwork specifically to prevent voters from having the, all the information, having information that people definitely think is relevant. Trump, for the record, denies having relationships with either of these women, and also claims that yes, they were paid, but he didn't do anything wrong, and you know they were paid off because that's easier than having them tell false stories, according to him. And then his lawyer took care of it, and he just paid his lawyer. And he, how would he know that that was an incorrect thing to do? So they have to prove that he knew what was going on. They have to prove some kind of intent. They have to prove that the business records were made incorrect in order to cover it up. One of their star witnesses is going to be the lawyer who did the payments. He has turned on Donald Trump. His name is Michael Cohen. He was Trump's fixer. He paid the women. He admits that. He actually served jail time for some stuff, and is going to say, Donald Trump and I had this conversation, and he knew what I was doing, and
did you say he's going to be,
told me to do it. And
he's going to be a witness or one of the lawyers?
So he is a lawyer who worked for Trump.
Right, I knew he was a lawyer.
He is going to be the star witness, against Trump for the prosecution. We don't know who all they're going to call. Like, there may be evidence that we're not expecting, but we kind of know what Michael Cohen is going to say, and he's going to be the major person. And one big question for the jury is going to be, do they believe this man who has gotten in trouble for lying and has done a lot of bad stuff by his own account, or do they think that he's like trying to hurt Donald Trump and not telling the truth because it will hurt his former employer?
So, but his lying that he's been caught in is lying on to favor Trump, correct?
In the past, yes.
Yeah.
We don't have evidence that he has lied to hurt Donald Trump, but we do have evidence that he has lied. Like he has told us that he has lied. The question is, like, is he telling the truth now?
Right.
Which is the kind of thing that jurors have to decide. Yeah, it's a regular thing that jurors have to decide. Do I believe this guy? Do I believe this guy? Do I believe this person? Do I not believe this person? Mm. So, amounts of money. Interestingly, I was curious how much money it was. One woman was paid $150,000. Another one was paid $130,000. And then to the lawyer, Trump kind of rounded up, so he paid a total of $420,000 to have these two people not tell their stories. One of them, interestingly, one of the women thought she sold her story to the tabloid National Enquirer, not knowing that National Enquirer had a side deal with Donald Trump, which is called a catch and kill, where he would pay for stories. And apparently the National Enquirer just has a file cabinet of stories that they're not publishing, that they buy, but because they're friends with the person it's about, they buy, which means they have the rights, which means you can't tell it to somebody else because you've signed a contract, and then they agree not to publish it.
Yeah.
So National Enquirer, as a side business, doesn't publish stories for money, which is an interesting media business. That's not how most of us do it. We also don't pay for stories, but we definitely don't pay for not stories.
Yeah. So
it's called catch and kill.
That's So does practice. That put the person, if she sold her story to the National Enquirer and the National Enquirer owns the story, is she allowed? This is a weird. It seems like that's a weird conundrum. That. Is she allowed to then testify about it in court?
Oh, okay. She's not allowed to sell it to somewhere else. But the story is actually now public.
Understood.
And definitely, just like, if a court tells you to tell a story, like, you can't go,
I already sold it.
Yeah, no, that's not. Okay. That's not the case.
Very good.
One other detail. Each felony, so these are felony charges, not civil charges. Each one comes with a maximum possible sentence of 4 years in prison.
Okay.
it would be normal if you look at other New York cases where people have been charged with falsifying business records. If they're convicted, if they're found guilty, it would be more common for them to serve them all at the same time. So you don't serve 4 years and then 4 years and then 4 years and then, like,
Right?
You do it all. The 4 years in prison for the one crime is also the 4 years in prison for the other time.
Yeah.
So you serve, like, 4 years.
Yeah.
Not everyone. There's also probation.
Yeah. Right.
Like, not everyone goes to jail or goes to prison who is found guilty of this. But it does carry a maximum sentence of 4 years per person. If Donald Trump is convicted and sent to prison, he can still run for president.
Right.
Can't pardon himself because it's state crime. Mm-hmm. Can still run from prison. It's not a disqualifying... you're not allowed to vote, but you are allowed to be president. That's the way our Constitution is. This, we know this. This has happened before. The socialist Eugene Debs ran from prison, ran for president from prison. If elected, no one knows what would happen.
Yeah.
He could still win in prison in New York. Would the prison move to the White House? Would the people come to... we don't know. We've never done this. Probably the courts would have to, like...
Hopefully that would be a little bit of a deterrent to vote for somebody.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
like,
obviously the more direct thing. But I do think it's just an interesting practical question. Right. Like, wait, what does this actually affect? It could affect voters. You know, there's going to be a lot of information about Donald Trump's life and pretty sleazy stuff that is going to come out. That's kind of known and established, but not been very well discussed. But yeah, there's also some very practical legal questions, which we do not know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we do know he can run from president for...
And do they give special dispensation to prisoners with phones, you know? Because it's like, well, you got to treat every prisoner the same, right?
So yeah.
Just visiting hours, he can do business just during visiting hours.
To not know how that's going to go.
As long as he gets a cell with a window.
There has been a poll sort of asking American voters what they think about these charges. And interestingly, they sort of described the charges and then said, like, do you think this is illegal? Not illegal, but unethical or immoral or just fine? And interestingly, about 31% of the country thinks it sounds illegal to pay hush money so that someone won't tell a story. 37%, so the largest group, say it doesn't sound like it's a crime, but also I'm against it, right? It sounds bad, it sounds unethical, but I'm not sure that someone should go to prison or that it breaks a law. And 23% said, yeah, sounds great. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
So we'll see if those numbers shift. Like that, I wouldn't count on that being how it breaks down. Answering in the abstract is always different, but yeah. Last thing I wanted to talk about with this story was just about the jury. I think it's really interesting. We don't know their names, their identities are being protected, but there are 12 jurors.
12.
Plus, I think 5 alternates was what they were saying. They were still talking about alternates before we recorded. These are just people that live in New York.
Mm-hmm.
They're registered voters, probably. They have addresses. They just get plucked from a hat. It means there were people that showed up at the courthouse to jury duty. And they didn't know it was going to be the president. It just happened to be the former president. They're just like, oh, I got to go to jury duty. I'm going to sit in this thing. Hey, what are all these news trucks doing here? Yeah. So one of them's in sales. Another person's in finance. One of them is
How do we know this?
They have to answer questions.
So we know the questions, but the reporters aren't allowed to...
The reporters, if the reporters learn their name, they don't report them. They sort of agree to protect these people's identity because it's high profile and people will show up and whatever. In this case, in particular, but that's true in every case. Mm-hmm. Like when I reported murder trials, I didn't say like, this woman lives at this address.
Yeah.
And if you're like friends with the murderer, like now you know, you kind of protect it. But people answer questions and it helps to know a little bit about their profile. So you say this many are black and this many are white and this many are Asian and this person's a school teacher and this person's a truck driver and this person like is unemployed currently or whatever. And they answered a bunch of questions like, what do you think about Donald Trump? And do you follow the news? What news do you read? That was a major, major question. What news sources?
Did anybody say?
No one mentioned Ben does not know what's going on. But man. I think, yeah, that'll have to wait for, we're not quite that.
Right, right.
Quite that big.
Soon.
But I just think for everything else, I just think this part of our system is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
And the, you know, in the court system here is doing everything it can to treat a former president of the United States exactly like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And he's doing everything he can to use all the power of his celebrity. And it's this straining between the system and this celebrity of, you know, and he's not the first celebrity to go on trial. It's not like we have no experience with this, but he is quite a bit of influence and quite a bit of power, and then it's a jury of his peers, which includes like a beat police officer and a tech guy and a finance person, and they have to weigh the evidence and make a decision, and that's amazing.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so often when we think about democracy and talk about democracy, we just talk about voting. Mm-hmm. And I hear people pretty regularly, when people do talk about jury duty, it's just this like, it's this chore, it's this grind. But there's a glory to it, and it's an amazing system that we're gonna trust regular people to weigh the evidence and be fair and make the decision about whether this is a crime, and whatever they personally think about Donald Trump, they've agreed to set that aside and weigh the law and apply the law to the evidence. And
yeah,
and that's why you should say yes to jury duty if you ever get the option. The other news story I wanted to let you know about, something we've kind of talked about before, but this is a new development. House Speaker Mike Johnson is pushing through a $95 million aid package. With money that's going to go to Ukraine, and money that's going to go to Israel, money that's going to go to Gaza for humanitarian purposes, and Taiwan. So you'll remember that Republicans were kind of resisting the aid to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Mike Johnson, who was not the first choice for speaker, but became speaker through a whole rigmarole.
Right.
And you know, and the things to kick him out are still in place. Like he's in a very precarious position. He decided to go against his own party to ask the Democrats to come in and support him and to go against some members of his party and try and push through this aid package, which is a version of the aid package that President Biden actually asked for.
That's fascinating.
And to support Ukraine against the wishes of the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah, that's kind of hopeful, right?
It's pretty interesting. So on Friday,
in terms of bipartisan, not
Friday morning, there was a procedural hurdle that they had to cross, and the Democrats, you know, one of the options for the Democrats is to withhold support and let the Republicans beat each other up
and destroy
themselves. They decided, the Democrats in the House decided, to let members make their own decisions on how they were going to do it. A bunch of them decided to support this. The procedural, it's not an important thing, but the procedural hurdle was crossed with a bipartisan vote, 165 Democrats and 151 Republicans. So
that's great.
One would expect that this bill will also pass.
I mean, that's a balanced
the House.
That's a pretty balanced
that's
bipartisan.
That's the most bipartisan thing we've seen in a little while.
And they didn't get held hostage by this extreme section.
There are Republicans who are saying they're going to bring a challenge and try and get Johnson kicked out of his leadership position. It would probably not happen before this bill gets passed, and it's not clear that it would be successful, that that's actually enough of them. But It could have consequences. One, it's a little bit surprising. We didn't quite expect Mike Johnson to be like this.
Right,
this wasn't his profile.
Right.
One interesting detail, something we covered at Christianity Today, is that, you know, he's a Southern Baptist. A bunch of Southern Baptist leaders, sort of national Southern Baptist Convention leaders, lobbied him specifically to support Ukraine. Specifically, mm-hmm. like, yes, a lot of conservatives and sort of far right and Trump people are against this, but as Baptists, we're actually in support of Ukraine. Russia is no friend to religious liberty. Russia has targeted Baptist and Pentecostal churches and tortured people when they've caught them. And, like, our, as Baptists, our concern for our fellow Christians, for other Baptists, definitely puts us on the side of Ukraine, whatever other evaluations of this conflict you want to do. I don't know if there were other reasons, but that's presumably one thing that pushed Johnson over the line. He gave a kind of interesting speech where he talked about history judges us by the actions we take, and this is a time of crisis, and if I lose my position, this is still the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Fun story? Interesting story? It's not hilarious, but it's good news.
Oh, yeah, I like good news. I'm interested.
So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
I'm sure there's an acronym.
FERC? I don't think they made the name.
They weren't thinking about that, were they?
For the acronym. They didn't come up with an acronym and work backwards like sometimes happens. So the old FERC, as everybody knows. No. The Energy Regulatory Commission recently announced that for the last 6 months, more new energy capacity has come from solar than anything else. So the growth of energy production, the increase month over month in energy production for the last 6 months, solar has been leading the way
in the growth, in the increase.
So overall capacity, solar power is about 8%. And hydropower, which is the next largest renewable energy, is a little less than that. It's just under 8%. But month to month, the increase in solar power has been like 70 to 80% of the increase in growth. So we're developing less natural gas. We're not fracking as much. We're not drilling oil as much. But what we are doing is adding lots and lots of solar power. And also wind. So that's what would be number most of those months. 1 month, the second most growth was in natural gas. Every other month, it was actually wind was the next thing. But it's increasing pretty rapidly. They're saying that in 3 years, if the plans work out, if projections are right and these numbers sort of increase, that there might actually be more solar power than natural gas.
I was talking to somebody about they were talking about all of the shortcomings of the solar panel technology and stuff like that, which that's valid to kind of keep on the radar. But just the increase also in technology, like the more that you're producing this stuff, the better
battery
you're going to get.
Battery technology, for example.
You don't get better at this technology that ultimately in the long run is going to be good just because it's not, the shortfalls, you have to see them as, are these shortfalls correctable? And is there a trajectory of minimizing the shortfalls? And it absolutely is because it's such a baby technology.
So
in
comparison. We had a really interesting test for this recently with solar power, of what happens in a when the sun goes away. Mm-hmm. We had an eclipse.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Turns out we were fine.
It was good.
The drop in solar production was real. You can notice it, but batteries kicked in. Storable.
Right.
Stored energy.
Yeah.
We were fine. To that connection, two of the largest states that produce renewable energy are also interestingly breaking records. So in Texas now, Texas produces more renewable energy than any other state. Just because of the
volume,
scale.
Yeah.
One, just because of the scale. There's so many people. Everything's bigger in Texas. But the other piece of it is that a lot of the old oil companies are just interested in energy.
Yeah.
And if they can make money from wind, they'll make money from wind. Heck yeah. They're not so ideologically committed to oil
purist.
That they're going to turn money down if they can. If they
or should
can
I
do
say
it.
Crudist?
So, so in Texas, actually, wind is the leading energy.
Yeah.
There's lots of windmills, but about 25% of all energy produced in Texas currently comes from wind power.
Yeah.
10% from solar power. So that's more than a third of the energy in Texas with all of the oil mills that have been running, oil wells that have been running since the 60s or 70s or 80s.
Yeah.
That's still above 30%. And in California, they just passed an interesting landmark. They just went over 25 days with 100% of the energy used in the state coming from renewable energy, mix of renewable energy. In a little bit more than a month, they've done it before, like for a few days at a time, but this is the longest they've been able to go without using any oil or coal at all.
Yeah. That's so cool.
It's still slow, and I don't want anyone to think like, global warming is over, you know?
Right.
Like, it's still, there's a lot to do, but we also miss often how fast stuff is changing.
Yeah.
And how this technology is changing, how people are changing, how states are changing, and regulatory systems are changing, and it's renewable energy's developing pretty quickly at the moment.
The other thing that's getting better that I just found out about, because my brother took a job there, is a job, it's an energy brokerage firm.
Yeah.
And what it does is they are the go-between, they're nonprofit as well, but they're a go-between for different states and cities.
To transfer energy.
For so
different
when,
places.
Yeah, and it's all energy. It's not just one type of energy. And I found that fascinating because then it's like with regards to certain states that can do renewable energy and produce more than they actually
use. Some places can produce more solar power, wind power than others.
Right, and we have to have
fun ways to share.
Yeah, we have that technology of transferring it over, and and you still, the states that make more than they actually use are actually getting a profit from that. So it's like there's compensation happening.
Yeah.
There's also sharing happening, and it kind of helps alleviate the burden for certain states that might not have immediate or the same room to grow in this area, they can still draw upon it.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's another fascinating part of the component that helps this continue to move and make us less dependent
on foreign energy sources, more secure at the same time. Yeah. I feel like for most of my life, renewable energy has been hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
It's been future tech. It's been like not quite science fiction, but pretty close to science fiction, and sometimes outright science fiction. And then there's always experiments that I think we've all seen where it's like, they're doing this, and it's like, yeah, that didn't work. You know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that was a good idea, but like, you can't compost your way out of this problem. Or whatever, you know, or have cars that like drop a thing and gather energy from friction on the road, right? Or cars that run on
water,
oil from the fry machines at the local McDonald's. You know, those whatever they work, but they're not quite scalable. So it's really interesting to see stuff start to rapidly develop and windmills and solar plants, solar power panels, and stuff changing.
As the world turns.
As the sun shines.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it. Another episode of Ben Doesn't Know What's Going On, aka Dr. Ben's News Time Radio Hour. Thanks to the Upstairs Sunday School for the use of the room, Daniel Cooper for the interstitial music, and you, dear listeners, for tuning in to another episode of Ben Doesn't Know What's Going On.